Okay, I'd like to get started. We are today going to be hearing testimony from the PCA and from others on the septic system rules that they have developed over the last year here. And we do have first on the agenda the Assistant Commissioner Rebecca Flood from the PCA. And also joining her will be Gretchen Sable, also from the PCA. And thank you for joining us today. And if you could state your names before you begin for the tape.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rebecca Flood. I'm with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Water Policy there. And we very much appreciate the opportunity to address the committee today and talk about the 2008 SSTS, or subsurface sewage treatment system rules, and the expectations for county ordinance revisions. With me today is Gretchen Sable, who is our SSTS coordinator. And I'll start right off with discussing with you briefly the current situation as we know it, review very briefly the review process and the proposed rule changes and what our expectations are for counties, and then how we've tried to respond to the various county concerns. But first, what I'd like to talk about in the current situation, the SSTS rule became effective on February 4th of 2008 and gave counties 2 years until February 4th of 2010 to update their ordinances, and that's something that is present both in the rule and in the statute. Through the rule implementation process, we became aware that technical corrections should be made to help further clarify the rules, and we would intend to move forward with those technical corrections and a rulemaking to clarify the 2008 rule. In light of this second rulemaking, counties have expressed concern with us moving forward with the ordinance revisions until the technical correction process is complete. Therefore, we would support a time extension for counties to update their ordinances, and we have met with the Association of Minnesota Counties to talk about this, and we've indicated to them that we're willing to work with them to amend the law to extend the deadline if that is the desire of this committee and the legislature. In the meantime, we continue to work with the counties on ordinance adoption because the statute still is in effect. 21 counties so far have already adopted revised ordinances, and others continue to work on theirs. The MPCA, in the meantime, we've tried to offer some practical approaches and provide some flexibility in terms of we've told counties that if ordinance revisions were in place by the start of the construction season, that we would consider that to be meeting the intent of the February 4th, 2010 requirement. And if the counties fail to revise their ordinances by that time, there is the potential for SSTS pass-through monies to be withheld if they don't revise their ordinances. And we certainly do understand some of the impacts of what we're talking about with counties, which is why we are here today to try to sort through what might be a solution to their concerns. I'd like to turn it over to Gretchen now to very briefly run through some of the background to the rule changes.
Welcome, Ms. Sable.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Gretchen Sable, and as Assistant Commissioner Flood said, I'm the SSTS coordinator. I think I've been here yearly for a number of years now talking about septic systems, so it's good to be back. I just want to briefly, is this auditory? I just wanted to refresh your memory that the first law for requiring statewide licensure passed in 94 and our first code was in 1996. So we're a relatively new program in a lot of ways. 97 saw some significant law changes that required counties to administer programs, so that was a big change then. And then the 2008 rule is our first major rewrite of the rules. So we've had a number of corrections along the way, but this is our first major rewrite. And we now have four parts to the rule where we had one before. What led to the change was that we needed to improve groundwater protection from large systems. We'd seen a number of large systems becoming, the number of large systems growing, and what was happening was there was a lot of water going into the ground. We were concerned about wells. We were concerned about other groundwater issues, and so we have now more rigorous standards for larger systems over 5,000 gallons. As you've heard here in this room, we've had issues with new technology over the years, how to get new technology into a rule in a flexible way that's still protective, and so we actually have a process for that now, and the process came through this rulemaking. We have new emphasis on system management, which is especially important now that we have more and more public money going into a lot of these systems through the AgBMP program and other funding programs, and so taking care of them is important as part of the permanent infrastructure, so we have some more requirements there. And then because systems are now a little bit more complicated, we have additional training required too through advanced certifications. And so those were the major changes in the rulemaking, looking at the environmental performance of septic systems over time and making some changes to improve that. We had a lot of input. I won't read this whole list of things. You can read that. But basically, as you know, the Administrative Procedures Act requires us to do public notice, and we've gone way beyond that with this rule. We've taken our language to a number of different venues. You can see them. We work with the regulated community. We work with other states. We work with trade and professional groups. We had a series of informal public meetings across the state, a special work group on large systems, and then work with specific industry representatives, the tank group, bonding people, and all that kind of stuff. Plus, we have an advisory committee. So we have a number of different avenues the public notice gets in. In the APA process itself, we opened the rules for hearings in or for public comment in 2007. So that's about 11 years after the first rule was written. We had hearings, we had a number of issues, and we made many changes to the rule based on those comments that came in at that time. And the judge found that, you know, we have an administrative law judge that works with us, and the judge found that we met all the requirements in statute and rule, that we have the authority to adopt the rule, that we did the additional notice requirement, that we met the requirements for cost and additional regulatory analysis, and that our statement of need and reasonableness reasonably supported the rule change and documented the need for the change. And so having gone through that process, then the rule became effective 2 years ago, February 4th, 2008. Within that, we did raise the expectations for our county partners. So we have the statute requiring ordinance change by 2010, so amending their ordinance was the first big change. We required they work with cities and towns because we'd seen issues where cities or especially townships would adopt the septic rule and then not enforce it as rigorously as a county or would seek to do things differently, so you'd have different protection within the county borders, and we require them to work together and at least be as stringent. And we require counties to administer effective programs. And to have an effective program, you need to review permit applications to ensure that they meet the requirements. You have to inspect the construction, either with your own staff or contract inspectors, and enforce compliance on systems that are either imminent threat, meaning they're surfacing, or failing to protect groundwater. There's different time frames the counties can set for that, but we need them to do that enforcement during that time. In return, what we provide to counties is technical assistance. We do enforcement. Our enforcement staff, we have staff in four offices, St. Paul, Rochester, Brainerd, and Detroit Lakes. And our regional staff do enforcement. They enforce license violation and also the straight pipe law that passed in 2005. And that's ones where if an inspector tags a straight pipe going to the ditch or a surface water or even just the land surface, special penalties are provided, and we do that enforcement as well. We are able to provide some funding, and as you know, it's been difficult, but we are always pinching away to try to get funding. So there's a block grant this year that's $9,931 because of cuts. It had been $10,000. The Clean Water Fund provides special project funds as well. Plus, we are providing educational grants to counties to help them to do that additional training so that those that are taking the additional training I talked about for the more complex systems can access these state grants through us, through our funds, to do that. We also provided a grant to AMC for a model ordinance, and that was completed around the time our rule was done. Another new requirement is that they verify that soil separation is met. You know that the soil, the dry soil under a septic system is how treatment occurs, and we've seen a lot of problems where poor decisions were made, or perhaps lack of knowledge on the part of the designer, and so we require now that a second set of eyes look at a new system to make sure that that separation is met, and that can be the county person. A lot of counties do it in a different way, for requiring a second inspector. Either of those work. We're expecting counties to make sure that management plans are provided so that homeowners know how to take care of their systems and are provided that information when they get them. We're requiring what we call an operating permit, which is an ongoing permit for larger complex systems, so that systems over 2,500 gallons or that have a pretreatment device or holding tanks, because all of those have to be taken care of or else they become problems. And then the county also has to have access to an advanced inspector, either on staff or through contract. And then, as Assistant Commissioner Flood said, we are proposing some additional changes. There was some typos, there's clarifications, some problem areas. And we realize this will affect local program because they're in the process right now of amending their ordinances. And we've offered them different options. They can adopt by reference with the future changes. I was just out in Traverse County this morning, and they were talking about an approach like that, where they adopt our rule with future changes. They can adopt by reference the current rule and include specific language from proposed changes. That's what Washington County did. They looked ahead to our proposed language, and they put our new rule language into their rule. Or they can adopt by reference and then change again after it's complete. And so then, the way the statute's written today, they just get two additional years once our rulemaking's done to make the further required changes.
I just want to point out, too, on Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that the technical corrections that we're talking about have been posted on our website and are available for people to look at and become familiar with. So they are able to see what we're proposing. So to review, the law and the rule require counties to amend their ordinances by February 4th of 2010. We've told counties that we believe the intent of the law would be met if they complete their ordinance revisions by the start of the construction season. And if revisions are not done by June 30th of 2010, it could impact grant decisions for the SSTS portion, pass-through portion of their natural resources block grant. We have met with the Association of Minnesota Counties to discuss the possibility of proposing a delay in the deadline until the technical corrections can be completed. However, a statutory change would be required to extend that deadline. And we'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Flood and Ms. Gable. I did notice you were saying the number of counties that did adopt ordinance revisions is 21 at this point.
Mr. Chair, correct? Members of the committee, that's correct.
Okay, so there's 66 that have not yet at this point. And I know there's an extension. You're looking at June 30th, 2010 deadline. Is it because of the number of counties that had not yet revised their ordinances that, that you were looking at the extension?
Mr. Chair, in September... Ms. Sable. I was invited to come to the Minnesota Association of County Planning and Zoning Administrators meeting, Big Pizza, and at that point was formally asked for, is there any flexibility? And at that point, the agency said to counties, yes, there is, and that was the answer that we said, that within the existing law, the law does say 2 years, but if you get it done by the beginning of construction season, there's no practical difference because you're not going to be installing systems, and then the question is, what do you do? What are the penalties? And the answer is, well, we would withhold funding in the next fiscal year. So that's where the June 30th came from.
Okay. Thank you. Representative McNamara has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And either for the Assistant Commissioner or for Ms. Sable, do you think that MPCA is doing enough to have an open mind? You mentioned, Ms. Sable, the process for incorporating new technology into SSTS design. And I don't know if you'd rather wait and answer these questions after some of the other testifiers, but I'm just curious. It seems like we're hearing different points of view on whether the agency is being flexible and considering alternative technology for different opportunities for folks that may want to just do it because they think it's environmentally the right thing, or they could live like where Representative Dill lives on an island in Crane Lake, and it's all rock, and a conventional septic system that works in Hastings might not work in Crane Lake.
Ms. Flood.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are provisions within this 2008 rule revision that allows for new different types of technologies to be reviewed and registered with the agency. So that's a provision that's never been in place in the rule before. So we do think that that's a good way of addressing that sort of an issue.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Assistant Commissioner, I think I'll just ask it kind of pretty blunt. Do you think that the legislature should put more effort on asking you to, instead of allowing local units of government to say you may allow this, and then having the challenge of where you make them have the duplicate system almost, you know, if they're on a small lot, and we're saying, no, you have to have enough room still, even if you want to put in this system that's not going to use what would be necessary if you were to put in a conventional system. Should we be putting more emphasis, should the state say, why aren't you considering this local units and you offering that more as an alternative to people? I may not be explaining it well, but I think you know what I'm asking.
Yes, sir, we do.
Ms. Abel.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, I thought your question was leading a different way, so if you want to step in here, you certainly may. We require that each new lot that's created have room for two septic systems. And they need to be systems that would be robust so that homeowners have a good system that's going to last them a while, and that they can build in a conventional way so they're not forced. Nobody wants to buy a lot that then you have to put a mega system on that costs a lot of money. It just seemed unfair to the homeowners. And so our rule since 96 has required two sites for a standard system. So, you know, it would be the will of the legislature if you want to change that, I think would be the way to say that. We did ask our advisory committee if they wanted to change that, because we know that it's not a good fit. A lot of local governments have talked about concerns with that, and the advisory committee recommended no change, and so the rule moved forward into this iteration with that piece intact.
Okay.
Just one last follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Ms. Sable, do you think some of the local units of government where it may be more advantageous to use this kind of a system, or it may even make more economic sense, small lots along lake shores with soils that don't work so well, do you think the local units of government know well enough the opportunity that's before them, and they understand it, or do you think sometimes they don't have the expertise? These either local townships or local counties may not understand, so they may be a little bit taken back. And I'm wondering, do you feel that you're playing a good enough role to let them know these options are out there?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ms. Sable. Yes, I do. We've done quite a bit to outreach to people. You know, we were working with St. Louis County, and they actually fostered a lot of these changes. They kind of led the way in dealing with these, and we've worked with them and learned from them. They're on our panel that reviews these products and helps us with the approvals, and so we've learned a lot from what they've been doing up there. Traverse County didn't know much about that today, and so when I was out there, I talked about the opportunities that these systems will provide for lakeshore development and for other kinds of places where it's a problem. And so I think that what we're doing more outreach to counties. When the 2008 rule went into effect, there was different deadlines, and so the deadline for using registered products just passed February 4th, 2010. So now we have a full set of products, and we're rolling them out now, so we're just beginning that outreach.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have Jim Mulder from the Association of Minnesota Counties.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Jim Mulder. I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I want to thank the committee for giving us the opportunity to speak to you today on what is a very important issue to counties and to our county staff people across the state. First, I want to thank Gretchen, as long as she's here, and all the work that she has done to try to make this thing work. This has been, she's been giving a really hard job to try to put this in place. When you think about Minnesota and all of the different Minnesotas that exist, I grew up in Renville, Minnesota, and it's almost impossible not to build a good septic system in Renville, Minnesota, because of where the water table is and what the soils are, et cetera, et cetera. But I've also visited in Coochesing County, and to try to figure out, you know, what's the best system in Coochesing County, that's a whole different equation. And sometimes, and I think one of the challenges that we faced is that we sometimes we're so focused on the perfect that we sometimes lose track of the good. That we need to find ways that we are more flexible, that we can deal with the specific situations that exist in all of those different Minnesotas that are out there. And tonight, I want to talk just about five things, and then I've got experts there that have been doing this stuff much more so than I, for sure, that could talk more about the specifics. But we saw really five issues that have come forward during this rulemaking process. The first has been is that, and I don't know that it's anybody's fault, but the process itself has been a moving target. Is that, yes, it got adopted, but almost immediately after it was adopted, we were informed, oh, by the way, there's a number of changes that we have that are technical in nature, but for some of our members, it is more than just technical. Also, at the time when we adopted these, this was in 2007, we lived in a very different world in 2007. If you look at the finances of counties in 2007 and look at them today, one of the things I will note for you that in 2007, the counties received $220 million of county program aid, or were supposed to. In the next year, it is estimated that we're going to receive $57 if the governor's proposal goes through. Now, I don't expect to receive only $57. I'm hopeful that the legislature will come up with a different proposal. But I'm pretty sure it's not going to be $220 million. So the economic conditions for counties has changed. In this rulemaking process that we were, you know, when we talked about adopting this, it ended up that the technical fixes can be more than that. And so our concern is that we need to have a broader discussion, I believe, that certainly the rules are in good shape, but when these technical fixes come forward, but we have to have a broader discussion about providing more flexibility, looking at what are the outcomes that we're receiving versus what are just the inputs that we are worried about. The second issue, and I appreciate the Deputy Commissioner for suggesting that a delay, the second issue is time. From our perspective, it does not make a lot of sense for anybody to adopt a rule and our lawyers are telling us, don't adopt a rule by reference that is going to be changing. So don't say, okay, I'm going to adopt the rule that I know is going to change, because you are really setting yourself up for some liability issues where you're going to now be putting in place in the ordinance what maybe you didn't realize was coming. The best way to do it is when the rule is done, after the technical fixes are there, is that counties at that point adopt the rule. Financially, we are encouraging a two-year period of doing it, primarily because over the last year, we have estimated that there's been a 10% reduction in county staff across the state. Almost all of these departments will tell you how stretched their budgets are, and adoption of a rule costs money. Implementation of the rule costs even more. As I've already talked about quite a bit, the county fiscal resources are stretched as far as we can. And I know in our redesign we've talked about the concerns that we have about continuing to work with rules and mandates that are ever increasingly putting more weight on our fiscal foundation. It was in some ways the good old days when our fiscal foundation kept growing. We had more workers, higher productivity, more revenue, more economic growth that sometimes was easy to kind of pile stuff on top of that. What we've seen in the last 2 years is that there's been a shrinking of all of those things. And it's very unclear to me, and I think it's unclear to county people across the state, of whether that base, that financial revenue stream base, can support more piling on. We recognize that yes, we have to deal with the most important, if there's a public health hazard, we've got to fix it. But we sometimes spend too much time on the margin, too much time on what the cost benefit of spending this money to what we're going to get in return maybe isn't always as great as it can be. Particularly, and I want to make sure people understand, this isn't just about the cost-benefit analysis of when you do environmental services, but the cost-benefit of analysis of what are you competing with. If we can get a better cost-benefit analysis for that dollar over in child protection or in another service that we provide, we need to provide that service. Each one of these dollars is competing in our counties today for the limited resources that we have. The fourth issue is the issue of enforcement. Sometimes I think people forget that the counties do not have broad enforcement powers that they can walk on somebody's property anytime they want. Unless there's an imminent public health hazard, counties are not allowed to just walk on somebody's property, whether it be for septic systems, whether it be our assessors, whether it be anybody. The property owner does not have to let you to go on that property. We are very concerned about and about the unclearness of this police power that we would need to be able to enforce all of these things as we move down the path. And I think it really needs clarity, and we really need to have a very good understanding over the course of time, over the next couple of years, about exactly how would we enforce some of these programs. The last issue is training. There is no question that training is an integral part of these rules. It's going to cost private individuals training, but it also costs us to train on how to do these functions. And each of those training programs costs money. So it goes back to that county fiscal issue. What we are asking for is really three things. The first is to allow counties 2 years after the technical changes are approved by the agency to adopt and update their ordinances. We're not going to be derelict. We're still going to be enforcing the current ordinances. We're still going to be dealing with the imminent public health hazards. But we think that at where we are today, that we can pause just a little bit and not let things get worse by any means, but maybe we can just slow it down just a tad to allow our fiscal situation to catch up. The second issue is to open up, as we look at the technical rulemaking, and when you talk about the 6 months and getting it in the ground, these rules, they have not even gone to that next process where the hearing, as I understand it, the hearing administrator has started to do it. I mean, that's still out there a ways, and we're going to have a lot of people who want to have input in this. And I think that they're going to be talking about the fiscal impact. So we believe that is going to take longer than just the 6 months or the spade in the ground idea or whatever else we're talking about. We need to give, I think, more latitude in when we need to, as the rulemaking comes forward. And then we also need to make sure that there's a broader way to review the rules as they are. And I know it's gone through the process, but I think many of the folks, now that the rules have been out there, people are looking at them, some counties are actually adopting them, there's a concern that, you know, maybe they're not as flexible as we'd like them to be, or that they need to be to do the best job possible, and for both the citizens and for the counties. And the third thing is one of our concerns, and if I heard them right, I'm very pleased. In some of the initial discussions regarding what the penalty would be if counties did not adopt, there were suggestions that not only would the SSTS grants be withheld, but other water and the NTS, or the NRBG grant, I think is what it is, and other grants would also be subject to be withheld by the department. In our it's our sense that's in a way cutting off your nose to spite yourself, because those things go to the other water programs. So not only are you going to penalize the septic system, but you would also penalize the other programs. Now, I hope that I heard that correctly, is that if there is a penalty, it will only be with the $9,000 or such, approximately $9,000 a year that each of the counties get, and not the other grants that are available to counties. With that, I'm going to stop and ask John Steiner to talk a little bit from, the Polk County, I'll let him introduce, I can't read the writing here, but I'll let John talk a little bit about it and then answer questions after these folks are done.
Okay, welcome, Mr. Steiner.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to be here this evening to speak with you about this issue.
And if you could just state your name for the tape.
Sure. My name is John Steiner. I'm with Polk County. I'm the Environmental Services Director for Polk County. I've been with Polk County for 14 years. Polk County has a countywide zoning ordinance that's been in place since 1992. We do countywide zoning that includes septic systems. Currently, we have 3 zoning staff in the department. They're responsible for administering all of the countywide zoning ordinances, the shoreland ordinance, and amongst them the SSTS ordinance. But that would be the 1996 version of that ordinance. Polk County has been very committed to the program. We do the design reviews, the technical standards reviews with our installers, answering questions for the homeowners, and the as-built inspections for all the contractors putting in new systems. Polk County also, in December of 2009, after some lengthy discussion internally, sent a resolution to the MPCA informing them that Polk County would not be adopting the SSTS standards proposed. We didn't do this lightly, but we just didn't feel that we could stand up at a public hearing and tell our residents at a public hearing that we felt these were the minimum standards needed to protect the environment. We were told in 1996 that those were the minimum standards needed to protect the environment. We still believe that. That's not to say that you can't make improvements in things, and certainly there are things that the MPCA has alluded to that need to be corrected, and we support that. But we do feel that this went overboard. But one of our biggest problems is that we don't believe that the SSTS standards that were in place since 1996 were implemented and enforced to the full extent available to them. An example of this, the county is responsible for administering the technical aspects of the SSTS program and making sure people get their permits. The MPCA is responsible for the licensing requirements, so making sure that licensed contractors are performing appropriately according to the requirements of their license, and to make sure that unlicensed contractors aren't doing work. In the SSTS program, there's somewhere in over the years been between about 1 in 3 state enforcement people that handle those issues, and they cover about, and maybe the MPCA can correct me if I'm incorrect, but I believe they cover approximately 60-70% of the state. I know with 3 people in our office trying to handle Polk County, which isn't even the largest county in the state, we have an unbelievable time trying to crack down on where we have illegal activity. So we feel that that was understaffed, and we're not making full use of the rules that were available to us. We've voiced our issues, as has the Association of Minnesota Counties and many of the counties through the process, both during the drafting of the rules, during the open public comment period, and then after the adoption of the rules to date. Unfortunately, a lot of those issues haven't been addressed, or at least not addressed to the satisfaction of many of the counties. I feel one of the issues that's going on with the process, and maybe it's a flaw with the process, is how counties are viewed during that input process. We're referred to as stakeholders in the process. But we, I guess, view ourselves as partners in the process. These rules are drafted, and specifically states in the rules, that the rules are drafted for the counties to adopt and enforce and implement. So in other words, we're doing the work on behalf of the state. To us, to me, That means that we rise a little bit above a Concerned Lake Association, a contractor, some of the other groups out there. And that's not to belittle their position on it, but just simply to say that we are in a true partnership in this rule process. And therefore, we think that we should have a say in what we can and can't do, what we have the resources to accomplish, what we have the ability to do, and how we do that. And I don't think that comes through in the way we handle the stakeholder processes. Unfortunately, the way the program has rolled out or been approved to date has resulted in some what we consider unacceptable results. Just in general, we feel we set the bar too high. Instead of setting the minimum threshold to protect the environment and public safety, and then encouraging enhanced standards where there's local conditions that require some additional measures, the rules are set higher, that we all have to account for those in our process, and then we can come in and ask for variances to basically not rise to the level the state has set. I think that paints counties in a bad light when it comes to this. It's basically saying that we're excused from meeting the minimum state standard. I don't think that's the message that we want to send. I know it's not the message I would like to send to the residents of our county. The costs associated with these programs are going to be very high. It's going to be high for us to administer. The NPCA went through some of the changes for you earlier as far as the additional site reviews. There's a lot of tracking requirements for counties as it relates to operating permits. There's going to be a lot of paper shuffling. In our opinion, a lot of document retention on our part that really isn't going to be used. There's also going to be a cost to pay for the homeowners. And what we question is, are you getting the bang for your buck? You know, that's an issue for everyone. You know, not only is the state strapped for cash, our county strapped for cash, but our residents are strapped for cash. And as we continue to add more and more requirements and more technical changes to these systems, they become more expensive, both in the permitting end and in the installation end. And that's going to be harder for our residents to deal with, and we question whether you actually get what you're paying for with that additional cost. The MPCA also alluded earlier to the status, if you would put it that way, of counties in terms of who's adopted, who has 21 of the 87 counties. I had 20, but 21 of the 87 counties have adopted to date. There's another handful, 10, 11, that are in the process of doing so, or at least the MPCA is aware that they have said that they're in the process. That leaves about two-thirds of the counties in the state of Minnesota that are just waiting. They're waiting to see what happens, and there's a lot of questions where we proceed from here. Without some sort of a statutory change, you have a bunch of contractors out there that don't know what rules they have to comply with, what they're going to do, homeowners that won't know what they need a permit for. There's just a lot of unanswered questions. But we do believe that this issue is not going to be addressed by simply postponing the timeline to adopt. As I said earlier, we believe that these standards don't meet to our satisfaction, something that we can adopt. Until we see some of those changes, I don't know that our position of our board is going to change until something in the rules is addressed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Steiner. And I just thought I'd mention this. We were going through this when discussing the landfill issue last week, as well as the issue of variances and the concern about the new rules in that area also leading to a number of variances being issued because there's an inability to meet up to the new rules and standards. I have the same concern. You know, we do want to make sure that, I guess, we have rules that are practical and that actually are workable. So we don't have to go through the variance process. And I hear you saying that many of these rules you feel are unworkable for a lot of the counties, especially given the limited resources and the dwindling resources the counties are going through at this time. As far as the stakeholder process, it sounds to me like there does need to be more input or I guess, more influence coming from the counties as partners, as you put it. I don't know if you have any suggestions as to what you think would make the process work better to make it more of a partnership so that we're working together and coming up with rules that work and that are cost effective.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's an excellent point, and I wholeheartedly agree with the stance on the variances. How we look at for our local ordinances, if we have to issue a number of variances on a specific issue, that means we have a problem with that requirement. When you're looking at variances being the norm, you have a problem with the rules. A variance is supposed to be set out for some sort of a hardship, basically where the application of the existing standards is not feasible or is an undue hardship upon that person, or in this case, a county. So when you have a number of counties saying that this standard or this standard is unacceptable to them, they're asking for variances. If those variances are being granted, to me, to our county, that would imply that we have an issue that needs to be addressed. So I would agree with you. On the second point related to the stakeholder process or the shareholder process, partner process, I think there are a number of options available to us. But I think what we need to look at, and be more than happy to supply you with some of those ideas at a later date so we don't take up too much time here. But I think there are some areas where if we do acknowledge that there is a shared partnership in this, that the state and the counties or a combination of the two could form some sort of a group that would bring a recommendation forward to act on for rulemaking. And I think that is totally appropriate. If this committee and this body is interested in doing that. Thank you.
Thank you. And next, we do have Mr. Terry Neff, Macon County. Welcome, and if you could state your name for the tape, please.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Terry Neff, Macon County Environmental Services Director. I've been involved and licensed or certified by the MPCA and ISTS since 1988. I started out as an inspector until 1995, and then I became the Environmental Service Director, so I oversee the department. John had mentioned before about, you know, when once you get out of state Minnesota, most of us Environmental Service Directors wear about 6 to 8 different hats. We have zoning issues, septic system issues, or administration, feedlots, Wetland Conservation Act, food, beverage, and lodging, solid waste. We have to do all of them with very minimal staff. I look at our county as one of the more progressive counties, and we have 6 people on staff. And currently, I'm down 1 from the previous year. We had some budget cuts at our county, and we were asked to cut back, and we're always asked to do more with less. I had 1 person retire, thankfully, or otherwise I would have let somebody go into office. So now we're down to 6, trying to do the same duties we've been doing for 15 years. And, you know, our county's large in size, low in population. We have a seasonal swelling of people about 80,000 and year-round people about 16. With all that lakeshore development, we're seeing 2,000 permits a year come in until the last 2 years, which has been reduced down to about 1,000, and 500 of them are septic systems. Now we're down to about 200-250. And you're trying to do that with just minimal staff. Now with these rule requirements, Mr. Chair, you mentioned the feasibility of implementing these rules. I'm going to go through and hit a couple areas about where we see it as more consumer protection versus environmental protection. The first one is septic systems. If you have a garbage disposal or you're pumped to it, you have to increase your septic tank size by 50%. That's been in the rule, and it's a good idea to slow the amount of solids out to the drain field. But now they've added the requirement where you have to implement an effluent filter with an alarm. This is it's a consumer protection issue, has nothing to do with water quality. It adds cost to the cost of the system installation. And if somebody didn't clean that filter, it ends up backing up in the house. So what they're going to do is take the filter out and throw it away. Nobody's going to put that back in there. Most of the people in our county, being seasonal people and retired people, they're going to have to hire somebody to come out and maintain it. So you got maintenance costs as well. One of the consumer protection issues. Another one is management plans have to be part of permits. They have to be part of the designs and enforced by the county. And these management plans have us pitting us against the neighbors, sending them nastygram saying you have to pump your septic system or see whether it needs to be pumped or not. Again, most of these are not year-round residents. Even if they are, we're kind of forcing ourselves on them, becoming in an adversarial manner with our public. And if they don't pump it out, now we have an enforcement issue. And I've talked with our county attorney, and I know some of the people up in the court system, and not doable. There's no way our county, they would need one attorney staff, at least one more attorney, in order to do that. They're not going to get it. We don't have the budget to add another $100,000 to their office, let alone us managing these with our current staff being cut. We can't keep up with the workload we have now. Now we have to start sending nastygrams to our citizens telling them they need to pump their tanks. It's a good educational portion, which education is the way to do it versus enforcing it on them through the counties. Then we're supposed to have permitting programs for operating permits and actually record permitting program for ISTS and record tracking. I called a consultant to see what it would take to do this record tracking, and it's $25,000 at a minimum to get that up and running. Plus, we're going to have staff to input all this information into it and maintain that. And it's $1,500 a year maintainer agreement for this program and an added staff that we're just not going to have. We don't have the people to do it. Not a bad idea, but it's educational. It can be done through education. When we issue a permit for a septic system, now we have to go out ahead of time and verify the soils information that the designer did. This has us going out to that property twice as many times for inspections on it, and we're overseeing somebody that's licensed by the state, they're bonded by the state, they've gone to the same training. I don't know why we can't do this at the point we do our inspection when we're going to be out there under normal circumstances. It could be done at that time, but that's an added burden onto us. And I don't know who we're trying to protect there. It's certainly not going to be us because we're going to go out there during the inspection. For these, I think Mr. or Representative McNamara had mentioned about, are we making it a little too difficult for the person on a small lot to employ some of these performance-based systems? Our county right now, we do operating permits for these performance-based systems. We have 166 of them going. It takes one staff member 2 months of his time to get one-third of them roughly per year renewed. We have them on about a 3 to 5 year basis. They keep coming up. So it takes about 2 months of one person just for them 166. Now you add holding tanks to that mix. It makes it more difficult. If we have to do operating permits on holding tanks, my county would have to give up allowing these performance-based systems on property because we wouldn't have staff to do them. So the requirements would make it more difficult, I think, for counties to employ these Type 4 systems. One thing that I never did understand why it's in the rule, we requested it to be out, is the installer, when he's done with the system, has to submit to the county an as-built drawing and the landowner an as-built drawing, and if he doesn't, we would have to enforce on that. So in theory, we would be enforcing on something we already have in our files because we did an as-built of it when we came out to do our inspection. So it's added paperwork, it's an added thing we have to keep track of. Mr. Mulder had mentioned about the training requirements getting more for counties. Right now we have to do one class, it's a 12-hour class. Now we have to do two classes in 18 hours. It's about $500 for me to send one of my staff members there. I have five of us that need to maintain our certification, so it comes about $800 a year. And that's not including the about $3,000. I think it was $2,940 it cost me to send one of my staff members to the advanced designer's training in order for him to learn how to put an aerobic tank in a tank in, which he's been inspecting for several years. Now the advanced designer, you have to have an advanced designer to do this Type 4 system. So it costs, either we have some members up here that are designers, and if you figure out the time it takes, it's about $3,000 to go through that class, if you're going to have to stay overnight. That adds cost to these designs, add cost to the system components, and it's an added cost all the way around to put a tank in the ground with a pump. It doesn't take the same technology or same expertise to put that aerobic tank in the ground as it does to sewer a 10,000 gallon day community, but that's the training level you have to achieve to put that tank in the ground. And I think I've run out of time, so I'm going to stop with them. But I'd like to get on some of the costs of system. I talked with some installers, some contractors, pipeline supply people. The added costs, and I was just found from one of the designers up there that I'm a little bit low. The added cost for the system, a regular mount system, is going to be $1,000 according to my figures. I had heard $1,400 from a person in the audience. The added cost of the LGU to implement this permit program, tracking program, maintenance, training, advanced training, for my office alone would be $107,350 startup cost. An annual ongoing cost to do this is $82,350. If I include our county attorney they would need, it would be $182,350. This is roughly what I would need on an annual basis. The cost to citizens for the permit is going to be, if the rules have it written in there that you technically would have to have a surveyor go out and survey the easement locations on the property. That can be changed. Assuming that's out of the rule where they don't have to go out there and locate these easements and identify them, it'd be $175 in permit cost for a mound system. The type 4 to 5 system would be $700 added cost. And I know I'm very low with the MSTS, which is the system's 5,000 gallons a day and above. The added cost of that, you'd have to have it for design review. The survey does have to locate easements by the language in there. 2-foot contours would have to be located or identified on the design. The groundwater calculations that need to be completed. A pit has to be dug. I have $5,180, and I know I'm extremely low probably on the surveying cost. And I guess I'll end with there. If you have any questions, I can ask them now or later when we're all done.
Thanks. Yeah, Representative Wagini has to have a question.
Back to the tracking system. I didn't understand exactly what you were. Just tell me a little bit more about that.
The rules require to have a permit tracking system, record-keeping system. So when you take a permit in, you would have to have a program to keep track of that, and especially with operating permits. You would need to know when these things come renewed, or when people need to pump their tank, you'd have to be, somehow you'd have to be notified. You just couldn't keep it in a little chart there. It would have to be on some form of computer system. And they do have them out there.
Okay. Representative Wagenius.
Okay, that was my next question. Can't the state get one system, and give a copy to each county or pay for a copy for each county? Computers are miraculous these days, and for record systems, it seems that what you need as a teenager to help us out here. But that doesn't seem so insurmountable to me. It seems like it's just one of those practical problems that could be solved, and maybe should be solved at the PCA level rather than at the 87 county level. And that they give you a system, and because I understand that it has to be tracked. But I'm having trouble seeing why this is so insurmountable.
Mr. Neff.
A lot of the permit tracking is tied in with your tax-based system, your parcel number systems. It's generated usually through there. And to get that compatible, we did it for our building permit program, and it's about $30,000. To get that system, so it would just do our building permits. And now we add in the pumping records and costs, plus you have to have a person inputting all this information. No computer genius, but we were quoted just for the holding tank permits, for operating permits, just for holding tanks, $12,000 for the system for that.
Yeah,
Representative Wagenius.
I missed again then. Okay, so it cost $30,000 to make a computer system that would be capable of working with your tax system.
Correct.
That's what I'm getting.
Yes.
Okay. But then why does it cost $15,000? Then I didn't follow you.
Mr. Neff.
The $12,000 for the holding tank and operating permit. That would be an added cost to put that onto our system.
Oh, an added cost to put it on the system?
Yes.
Okay, so now you're at $42,000.
We have our building permit system. We could get our holding tanks, hard that, but now we're going to have to include, which we're figuring double, to get records management system for the pumping and maintenance of these systems. Mm-hmm. And then it would all be tied in as one.
And so you're thinking that's 40-some thousand a county?
Well, for our county, it'd be about 25 to do it. Maybe higher for other counties, but okay, we should be able to get down to about 25.
Okay, $25,000 for a county to do that.
Correct.
Have a lot of counties done it already? I mean, I don't see that as an insurmountable.
No, it's a one-time cost. The ongoing maintenance of that with staff is a reoccurring cost.
Right. But people go out with these little systems in their hand and put it in. It's not paper anymore. I mean, nobody carries paper anymore if they're good.
Correct.
Okay. So about $25,000 for a system that ties into your record tracking system.
For our county.
Mr. Neff.
Okay.
Okay.
That's
thank you, Mr.
That's
Neff.
That's what I was trying to figure out. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Neff, if you could recap again, prior to these rule changes coming forward, and I don't know if it was you or Mr. Steiner that testified that your observations were that the environment was being protected under the rules that were current as of then, and that largely these expanded rules don't seem to be necessary. Is that accurate?
I would say yes.
Okay, Mr. Neff.
I would say for the smaller size system, yes. I'm not, you know, their MSTS, which is your mid-size systems, are 5,000 gallons a day and above. I even told the PCA, most of us counties probably would have trouble managing them, and we would love to see the PCA include systems from 5,000 gallons a day and above underneath their FCS permits. Let them manage the system. We can handle the systems 5,000 gallons a day and less. Some may disagree with me, but coming from the local level, I see that would be a great thing. Let us manage these systems under 5,000 gallons per day. I think our existing rules do an adequate job of that, and we don't need all these other protection devices.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Neff. And I think one more question, then we'll move on to the next testifier. So, Representative Wagenius.
Okay. When you're saying systems below will manage and systems above, you want the PCA, you're talking about enforcement here?
Mr. Neff.
Everything. Have these 7080 or our ISTS rules for counties up to 5,000 gallons a day. And then from 5,000 gallons a day and above, PCA could administer, enforce, and regulate them systems.
Okay. One of the themes I'm picking up here is that nobody wants to enforce. I mean, and that's one of the reasons we've had so many. We still have a lot of systems out there that are, what is it, public health. I mean, they're endangering public health. And we still have scads of those, and it has struck me that.
Mr.
Personally, I don't agree so much with imminent public health, because then you're looking at straight pipes, something discharging to the ground surface or backing up into the dwelling. I think they're a small part of what we see out there, out in the field. Failing systems with less than 3 feet of separation, they're the ones we find out that are non-compliant. They're maybe not protecting groundwater quality as the rules would like them to. You're getting some treatment. A lot of these are in isolated areas that, you know, you, in our rural Aiken County, you have roughly 8 people per square mile. You know, that's about 2.3 buildings per square mile. It's probably not a big water quality issue in our counties. In the lake country, maybe it is. Usually have more sandy shorelines on a lot of lakes. Yeah, if you look at the parcel, the transfers of property over the last 10 years, we don't have many systems that haven't been upgraded on our lakes.
And Mr. Steiner?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to get back to the comment by the representative over here. I was the one that testified to that, and I do agree with Mr. Neff. You know, the backbone of the 1996 regulations was that you needed 2 feet of separation from the bottom of your drain field trench to the seasonal saturated level in the soil to get 97-98% of your treatment. There's an extra 1 foot required to get you a 3 foot separation, which was considered buffer. and that was deemed adequate at that time. I have yet to see anything that changes that we get our treatment in that level. So that was a basis of my testimony, is that we have been doing that since mid-90s and continue to do so, regardless of what happens with the rules we're here discussing today. And that's in relation to, I think Mr. Neff clarified this earlier, the your typical septic system, the one at your house or your lake cabin or, hooked up to, your campground, whatever it would be, your smaller systems. The larger systems are a different animal, and I did testify earlier that there are some changes that probably need to be made with the rules with regard to that. There are always room for improvements.
Thank you, Mr. Steiner. And we'll move on to the next testifier. We do have several testifiers left, and we do have an Environment Finance Committee that's going to be meeting in here after we're done. So welcome, Mayor Pawlowski, and from Roseau. If you could state your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Pawlowski, and I'll clarify in a minute, but I'm the Roseau County Environmental Director. Been on that job for almost 21 years, and I'm also, so I know a lot of you look familiar, and I probably do too, but I'm also finishing up my sixth term as the mayor of Roseau. So I'll make this real quick. I don't want to be redundant. I have a lot of testimony, but I'll forego. I don't, in the sake of redundancy, but I was asked to talk about partnerships. John touched on it a little bit, or the lack thereof in this program. And, I've worked on through the 21 years. I handle solid waste management. I handle floodplain management, shoreland, SSTS at the county level. We have a little Roseau County has about a $1.3 million environmental budget with 10 employees. And on top of that, I've worked with countless agencies in our flood recovery in the city of Roseau. And to add a little expertise to the whole looking back at this is the programs that worked. I mean, some of them, they find a way to work. Some of them are more difficult than others through the process, but the ones that work are the ones that have partnerships formed. The ones that don't, they fall in on themselves. And I think that's been a problem with this program from the start, back to 1996. Gretchen's worked very hard on this whole process. I give her all the credit in the world. But, the county's had a hard time from the start buying into this program, and they're not buying into the revisions that are going on here. And I think the main reason is because those partnerships don't exist. And Mr. Chair, you asked the question, how do we get at that partnership? And there are a lot of ideas out there. I think it's clear the SSTS advisory committee process maybe wasn't, we had a county commissioner that was on, a member of that committee, that didn't work. Maybe we need to do something else, but we need to do something, because Mr. Neff touched on it. I mean, he has all the expertise, way more than I do, about just the technical problems in these rules, let alone administering this program is difficult. And then you throw it into the fact that nobody's buying into it. I mean, nobody is buying, none of the sectors buying into these rules, with the latest tweak being 84 pages, and to be asked to adopt ordinances to adopt those rules, a moving target by reference, it just isn't cutting it. So we would ask, back to Mr. Mulder's testimony, that I think he laid out the plan that we'd like to see. I think the key thing is rather than just do a 6-month or 2-year extension, I don't think it's going to work without changing the process and how we're going to come up with the final rule, because we can push it back as long as we want. And yeah, we don't have the money to implement the programs, but in 2 years, if we don't do some major changes to these rules, they're not going to be acceptable then either. So I think we should spend our time now figuring out how we're going to get at these rules and improve them so we can come up with workable, enforceable program so everybody wins. Because right now, like John said, I couldn't stand up at a public hearing and try to defend these. It just isn't going to work. So with that, I'll be quiet and take any questions if you have them.
Okay. Thank you, Mayor. And Representative Saylor has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, this question would be for all three of you and AMC. I'm just wondering, in the letter from AMC, it was referenced that, you know, you see that there are some parts of the rules that you agree with. Have you prepared a list? Do you have a list of the parts that you agree with so that we can see, you know, as you said, it's not all bad, but I would be interested, and I think the committee would be interested in knowing which parts you think are workable. You know, you've told us about the parts that aren't. I'm just curious.
I don't have any list of what I would agree with. A lot of it is we already have in our ordinance, but I do have, I got here 11 pages of what I don't agree with. You know, some of it has been corrected in what are supposed to be corrected in the 84 pages of tweaks they're doing to it. So I have my list. I don't have list, but that one's down to about 6 to 7 pages. But there's still some things that they're problematic, but there's a lot of a good in it. I guess it's the good stuff I like is what we have in our rules already that we are administering, enforcing, and thinking it's doing a good job.
Yeah. And instead of reading the lists, you could probably just give them to Representative Saylor. So, you know, Representative Junk.
Well, I guess just a general comment. I want to thank the counties for coming up. I don't know how many times we have to repeat it, but Mr. Mulder stated it well. I mean, we're in a different age and era right now. You know, if we're going to continue to send these mandates on, again, this wasn't a legislative mandate. This is from the department. Unfortunately, we get fiscal notes, and the fiscal notes we get in committee say, here's the local government cost. We see those, but we're not seeing the fiscal notes when the departments do it by rule. And so, you know, it's not even a legislative problem at this point. It came from the departments. And so I do advise, Mr. Chair and others, it is time to take a real long, deep breath on this subject. It is something that's been going on for years and years and years. It isn't settled. And to now shove this down on the counties, you know, without sending them the money, you know, unless you're going to put a STOP sign on local government aid cuts and aids to counties and cities, and whether you're going to truly make them partners, where they are delivering our services just like in healthcare and everything else, this is not the time. It is the time to listen to counties. And that's what I'm telling my commissioners at home, that I'm happy to support them on some of these things, because it is a different time frame. And, Mr. Chair, I don't think, you know, I appreciate what Representative Saylor just said, that we should take a look at what isn't working. It is. Yeah, we should, but we don't have time. I think our policy deadlines are going to be about March 12th, unless you want to start meeting every night and doing septic rules. We don't have the opportunity or the time to do this right now. And the other thing is, and I don't have to remind members, you know, 90% of these units are outside the metro area. So we're talking about rural counties, a lot of them small, a lot of them under 5,000 people. And these guys got big staffs compared to some of the counties. And so, I mean, we really have to get a handle on this. And, Mr. Chair, I would advise that you and your staff craft something together that would get us to the next session, that would put a stop to it temporarily. I'm also a little, I'll finish now, but I'm also a little, after I state this, I don't like that the counties are threatening to withhold money on other programs. I don't know where they get the ability to do that. I'm seeing that in other agencies. For other things with their withholding money that I don't think they have any right to do. I will turn a sympathetic ear to them to a certain point in that they're being required to fund their operations without new capital. And that's what's going on in this place. And if you've been here long enough, you certainly understand that. If you sit on a fiscal committee, you certainly understand that. And frankly, we're actually seeing that. As you know, in our committee, Mr. Chair, tomorrow we're going to hear that they've actually collected way too many fees in agriculture, so we can just simply put them over into the general fund operating budget. That's how we're balancing budgets around here. So we're collecting fees. We're, you know, funding our agencies that way, and that's not their fault. But now to say we're going to withhold grants and other monies, I'm just not sure where that authority comes from.
Mr. Chair, if I can,
Mr. Mulder,
Representative Yonkin, I hope I did not misspeak. what my suggestion is that we have no authority to withhold other grants that come into the county, but we put property taxes and local revenue streams into all of these programs. I would be hard-pressed to tell you a single program that has been fully funded by the state. So we are faced at some point with the own source revenues, deciding where we're going to put them and what's the cost benefit that goes with them. And so I hope I did not suggest that we were going to somehow withhold a state grant from a...
No, not you, Mr. Chair. My question to you is how are they telling you they're going to enforce Polk County for not adopting the rule? What is their punishment and what is their authority to withhold? You talked about it, other water funds that now actually start escalating your problems because now you don't have the funding to address other things. That's my question, not what you're doing with it once it comes in.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bianchi, it was our understanding that there, in one of the correspondences from the department, there was a suggestion that they would withhold not only the SSTS grant, but also the
Bowser
grant, and what's the other one?
Water planning.
The water planning grant.
Very interesting.
And whether we said that we didn't think they had the authority to do that, and that's been up for discussion. So I was happy to hear tonight that they didn't reference those other grants when they talked about their authority.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Mulder. And I think we'll move on to the next testifier here, Mr. Eric Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for allowing me to speak. My name is Eric Larson from Malacca. I serve as the Vice President of the Minnesota On-Site Wastewater Association, and we, too, have worked with the agency as partners for a long time, over many years, and desire to do so in the future as we move forward in this industry together. I'll be brief. Our membership includes contractors, board licensed professionals, educators, suppliers, and regulators that come from many counties. The majority of septic regulation around the state is administered by county programs, and we are very sensitive to the concern expressed by the Association of Minnesota Counties. The letter that Ms. Sable referred to and Assistant Commissioner Flood had signed, that they're willing to accept the delay for until June 30th, refers to the minor amendments, and as the previous testifiers explained to you, that minor amendment is now some 84 pages. I'd counted 82. I guess it's grown. And many counties have expressed great concern to us about the sheer volume of changes that are needed and the difficulties created by some of the current language compared to how it may end up, and we can split those nuances if you wish. But there is another issue that ties to the situation at hand. It's especially germane after Mr. Pawlowski's comments, and that's that in state statute in 115.56, which stands beneath the septic rules, it states that licenses issued under this section allow work on subsurface sewage treatment systems that do not require state permit using prescriptive designs and design guidances provided by the agency. This is current language. It was adopted in 2008. So it is in place whether this rule implementation is delayed or not. This is currently in statute. The design guidance is currently grown to some 200 pages of length. Understanding in our industry as this began, the design guidance document development began, was that it would be just that, a guidance document to provide reference on septic system design. County regulators would need it to review designs for permit applications, especially on the mid-sized systems we mentioned earlier. And designers would use it as to apply concepts in various situations they would encounter in the field. It's incomplete for these purposes, however, and although there is some excellent content as is currently written, the agency has not provided guidance in a few areas in which it is needed. And senior staff in the wastewater division has stated they do not intend to provide this guidance, that they've gone as far as they're going to go. So this creates a really remarkable situation here where there's a guidance document that's now controlling the licenses that can perform the tasks of septic system design. And in addition, you're going to find in the proposed rule updates, the 84, 82 pages, numerous locations in this proposed rule revision where it states that the design guidance will be adopted by reference with the rules. So this will increase the Minnesota Rule 70, 80, 83 effectively by 200 pages, These 200 pages have not gone through the normal public hearing process that rules do. You know, sadly, from my perspective, I mean, it does raise a question of the agency intent when the language was added in 2008. We were negotiating that, and had this been the known end result, we meaning MAWA, would not have probably adopted that. But Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we wanted the committee to know that MAWA is looking at possible legislation to correct this, but there's another issue that ties to the issue you guys are discussing today.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Any questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Next we have Mr. Roland Freyen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Hello.
My name is Roland Freyen. I'm a manager of the Clearwater River Watershed District, and I'm going to read this statement in the interest of time. You don't need an old English teacher being extemporaneous here. Early in this decade, the Clearwater River Watershed District constructed, with PCA permitting, two Class D community wastewater systems serving 100-plus homes on the shores of Clearwater and Grass Lakes in Stearns County. The system included five monitoring wells. Recently, the PCA required a system upgrade to Class C, which called for an upgrade of the operator's license, one additional monitoring well, and additional monitoring. I applaud the due diligence shown by the PCA in protecting the groundwater and associated surface water of my neighborhood. Thank you. I appreciate it. However, I am perplexed by the lack of attention shown the remaining 70% of individual septic systems surrounding Clearwater Lake. Many of these homes are built on a 50-foot frontage of filled land. Stearns County has recently compiled an impressive shoreline zoning ordinance requiring a 2,000-square-foot lot size and reasonable setback requirements. It's an excellent ordinance. However, I know of no undeveloped property for sale on Clearwater Lake, and most current homes cannot meet these standards. Now, we've looked at some of the new technology that's available, and much of it is very impressive. It is impressive. However, you have heard the trouble that Aiken County has in managing the numerous wastewater treatment systems that are developed around lakes. It seems to me that we need to move from individual solutions to community-based solutions. I am indeed jealous of areas like Alexandria and Green Lake Spicer that have installed community systems around their lakes and have been very successful in doing so. So I think we need to look at a change in direction. I'm reminded of the Chinese proverb, if we do not change our direction, we are likely to end up where we're headed. And also, important is the definition of sustainability from the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Bill. Water use is sustainable when current use does not harm ecosystems, degrade water quality, or compromise the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. I think that last line is very telling and very important. And instead of spending our time wondering if it is financially feasible to do what needs to be done, I think we need to look at what's right and what needs to be done. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Freyland. Questions? Representative Wagenius has a question. Mr. Freyland,
I don't have a question. I just want to thank you for bringing up the fundamental issue here, and that is maybe 70% to 80% of Minnesotans drink their groundwater. And this is a drinking water question. And it's not a septic question. It's how do you protect your drinking water? So thank you for bringing it up. I mean, that's one of the things that we're seeming to miss sometimes when we're talking about these septic systems. There's only one reason to do it, and that's to protect drinking water sources, not only your own, but your next door neighbors, or maybe your lake. And that is a missing piece of this discussion until this gentleman came up.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Freyland. Did you want to respond?
Well, a cursory survey of scholarship in that area at St. Cloud State or at St. John's familiar, you may be familiar with that school, I don't know.
Yeah.
shows that there's considerable scholarship and evidence to show that our septic systems and our septic plants are not doing much to take care of the pharmaceuticals that are going into that stream. And there's a lot of evidence to show that it will have impact on our drinking water. And I think we make a very good point. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fralin. And Mr. Fralin was speaking to the fact that I taught at St. John's, and I remember Mr. Fralin from my St. John's days. So good to see you again.
Thank you.
Next, Mr. Clint Elston and Roberta Elston.
To save time, we'll come together. Mr. Chair and
Welcome.
Members of the committee, thank you so much for giving us this time.
And if you could state your name for the tape, please.
Yes. My name is Roberta Elston from the Aquarius Corporation, 15711 Upper 34th Street South in Afton, Minnesota. And if I may, I'd like to take a moment to explain our black water, gray water separation technology. We separate the toilet waste and the kitchen organics right from the sources, i.e., the toilets and the kitchen garbage disposal. Our toilets use 2/10 of a gallon of water per flush instead of 1.6 gallons. So there's a lot of water savings there. And we actually want you to have a garbage disposal because the kitchen organics help to offset the acidity of the human waste. This also reduces the kitchen organics from the home going to a landfill. These resources are then sent to our biomatter resequencing converter, BMRC, fancy name for a composter. We begin with a pine bedding and potting soil combination before adding our resources. The pine bedding gives us the carbon source and the porosity needed to form a rich compost environment. In this environment, 95% of all organics just disappear in the form of harmless carbon dioxide and water vapor. The composter also takes care of any pharmaceuticals the family may be taking. And what we've learned is that through time and temperature, they are broken down and rendered useless, thereby not affecting our environment. We then have an extended aeration gray water treatment plant for our gray water, which is basically comprised of some soaps and organics from the laundry, shower, bath, and kitchen sink. We then utilize our water recycling system, which uses a 1 micron filter, a resin tank, ozone, and reverse osmosis to clean the gray water to return it to a totally reusable quality to include drinking. All of this is also monitored via a computer. With this technology, we, as well as our customers, have been able to reduce our need for water by 40 to 98%, wastewater pollution by 95 to 100%, hot water and radiant heating costs by 60 to 90%, and organic kitchen waste to landfills by 95%. Because we are an ISTS, Individual Sewage Treatment System, we feel that combining the ISTS and the SSTS acronyms should not occur. We do not utilize the soil for treatment. We are a black water, gray water separation technology, not a commingled SSTS technology, which does use the soil for treatment. We are then a closed loop, zero discharge, potable water home, and we extend to each of you a personal invitation to come to Afton and tour our home and see our technologies in operation. They do work. Utilization of separation technology will only help to create jobs in this state, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Elston. Mr. Elston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to say something's kind of interesting is that...
Maybe you can just state your name before...
I'm sorry, Clint Elston with the Aquarius Corporation, Afton, Minnesota.
Thank you.
One interesting thing today is, like you stated, I graduated from St. Cloud High School in 1965, and my senior high school English teacher was Mr. Roland Freund. So if I don't get my English correct here, I'll probably get a bad grade on this one. Anyway, the first thing I want to talk about is that everybody wants to talk about septic systems. Okay, well, what this used to be in 1995 was individual sewage treatment systems. And everybody now from the MPCA wants to put it into the category of everybody having to use the soil as treatment of sewage. And that's not necessarily so. Our technology, as well as various other manufacturers, manufacture gray water treatment separation systems. Presently, your SSTS rules are the ones that are proposed actually in what's called 7080.0100. It says that you have to, that your Well, let me get this straight. There's type 1 through type 5 houses. The type 1 house is a gray water treatment system which allows a 40% reduction in the size of the leach field. Presently in your 7082 subpart 3, item F states that you have to have two full-size septic systems to be able to build on a lot. Our point is that, and our question to the commissioner was, why do you insist upon having two full-size lots when you say that you can put a reduced-size gray water system on under 2240? The answer from the commissioner was, well, if you build that energy-saving, water-saving, pollution-reducing house and somebody wants to come and buy it and change it back to a energy-consuming, water-pollution, water-consuming house, that we have to have enough room for it. Our point and back to him is, why in anyone in their right mind want to change it back to something that's going to cost more money to do, that's going to tear up more trees? So presently, the way that these regulations are written is discriminatory in regards to gray water treatment system manufacturers, not only the Aquarius Corporation here in Minnesota, but throughout the United States. So where a person has a small lot, and I brought a little demonstration here, this is Mr. Froyan. Here's Clearwater Lake, here's Clearwater Lake, here's Mr. Freund's property, there's my property, there's some other people's property. I don't have enough room to put two full-size septic tanks. This guy doesn't have enough. This guy might have to buy that lot to be able to do it. So these two lots are worthless. So they sit there, and the state of Minnesota doesn't make any money from it because they're just sitting there because we are not allowing gray water treatment systems in. There are thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars that are being restricted in job creation, manufacturing, and putting in systems that utilize separation technology and are not septic systems. The present rules, the way they are presently written, that have been this way since 1995 and are only getting worse, are equating to the horse and buggy and the automobile. And the rules back then used to say that if a horse and buggy and an automobile approach each other, the law was that the automobile had to pull over to the side of the road and stop the engine in order to not scare the horse, or a human being had to be walking in front of the automobile with a red flag waving it. And that's where we are right now. In order for us to change that, we're going to have a paradigm shift, and we're going to have to do it pretty soon, because presently, since what I've seen since 1995, things have only gotten worse. Under your Clean Water Revolving Fund project priority list, since last year, you went from 260 communities looking for $1.8 billion to this year 210 list, which is looking for 381 communities at $2.4 billion. A septic system's estimated life is 7 to 14 years. If you have two lots to support both of those, that means that your property is going to only be worth anything for 28 years. After that, you're done. So the present way we are doing it is not working. We are not solving the problem. The economics that can be created by allowing non-discriminatory practices such as what 7080 and 7082 are doing to gray water treatment systems manufacturers is dynamic. If I can make one analogy, there was a gentleman by the name of Preston Tucker in 1947 that invented an automobile. It had safety glass, it had seat belts, it had a whole bunch of good things. What ended up happening was, is he went to court because he borrowed some money and he went to case. What he stated to the jury at that time was that he believed in the American spirit. He read a lot of Buckminster Fuller, but then it was Ford and Edison. And he stated if a guy came up with a crackpot idea that might revolutionize the world someday, the bureaucracy broke him down and he never got his head above the water and never did it. And that's exactly where these regulations are doing it right now. We are poised to be able to create thousands and thousands of jobs. We need to convert all of our public buildings to energy-saving, water-reducing, pollution-reducing technologies. If we do this, we will create endless numbers of jobs by taking that paradigm shift and creating new opportunities instead of miring ourselves in one single technology which assumes that we can only use the soil to be able to protect us. I sincerely appreciate your time today. We all invite all of you, which we've already done in writing, to come to Afton to be able to see a home that is a zero discharge home. We are actually using our well and our septic system right now as our heating system with geothermal hybrids, and we, like Bobby said, we've been able to reduce our heating costs by 60 to 95%. If we start doing this to our public buildings, if we start realizing that planning and development is not predicated upon having to have sewer systems and water systems, and we can decentralize our society, that way we will stop our moving ourselves around. We will not have 35W bridges collapsing because we have to move to someplace that's got a toilet that's on the Met Council. Decentralization will create productivity and a better environment for us and our entire planet, and something we can export to other countries.
Thank you. And we do have a couple more testifiers, but we do have one question before we move on. Representative McNamara.
Well, it's more just a comment, Mr. Chair. I want to thank you for allowing the Elstons to come and testify. It was, I think, an important message. It's a little bit different to have in your basement the composting going on and the angleworms and all that, but it's very interesting. And some of the members from here have been out, and I appreciate that, and invite any of the other ones. They're very serious that they're open to anybody coming and seeing what they're doing, because it is different, and it's hard for some people to fathom, but it's extremely interesting. Thank you.
Thank you. We will have to take a field trip down there sometime.
Please come on up.
Well, thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you very much
for your time.
Next we have a Lowell Pajari. Mr. Pajari. Welcome to the committee, and if you could state your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. My name is Lowell Pajari. I live at 3300 190th Street in Prior Lake. I've been a Scott County resident for 35 years. We have 58 acres there, Spring Lake Township, and I'm the developer for a green community we've been planning for 3 years. The concept of our community is to create a sustainable landscape with wildlife habitat using some green technology. All of the common land in the community would be dedicated to natural habitat and parkland rather than sewage treatment. The heart of each home in this community is the water and sewage separation technology. Our goal is to reduce water and wastewater pollution by 100% and water consumption by 95%. We want to purchase a wastewater treatment system that would be used in each home manufactured in Minnesota by Minnesota-based companies, but our current sewage ordinance doesn't allow for anything other than sewage mounds. Sewage mounds don't create a natural wildlife habitat, and they don't protect our environment and our groundwater. Sewage mounds are not even safe. If they were safe, there wouldn't be 200-foot setbacks for public trails and 600-foot setbacks for recreational areas, so why would we want them in our yard where our kids can play on them? When there's clearly a much better option, without the right to incorporate the latest sewage and water technology, a community such as we've planned is impossible, and that's going to cost us lots of jobs in our community. The problem with commingled sewage mound systems is they fail. That's not the case with Aquarius technology. Repairs to the system were done by changing a defective component, which is as simple as changing a pressure switch in a well. By not including the use of technology, advanced water and waste systems in our state's ordinance, you're denying the citizens of Minnesota the right to choose environmentally safe living for their families. You're denying the citizens the right to use technology that saves them money while insisting they use their property for a sewage dump. I don't believe that this state and its municipalities should be simply reacting to the old problems in the same traditional approaches that ultimately result in more dramatic water waste and pollution. Today we have an opportunity to improve our infrastructure using innovative approaches and paving the way to economic prosperity. And that prosperity comes to the state and the county and local governments by making unbuildable properties buildable. And these properties that would otherwise not be built on now become sustainable ongoing sources of revenue for the government. Local governments are paid fees, licensing, permits, and certification. As for the citizens of Minnesota, economic prosperity in part comes from the savings that occur through use of technology. That's why people trade in their old refrigerator for the energy efficient one. Well, awareness of water and scarcity is and its impact is increasing, the operative word in this pending crisis is management, not just in terms of reducing water footprint and finding new ways to meet ongoing demand, all of which is important, but management in the context of reducing the unbelievable water waste that occurs due to the lack of infrastructure innovation. thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Pajari. Okay, seeing no questions, moving on to our next testifier, Mr. Pete Gillen. Representative Wagenius.
Just a question as he settles in. I know we're kind of running out of time, but would there be a time that we could have PCA come back and talk about these new septic systems and why folks feel that they can't be used under these the new rules? Is that something we could ask about at some point?
Sure. And would you like to call him up after the testifiers today to respond once, if we've got time? And it's your committee that we're running into, so it's up to you.
Or at some other time.
Okay.
But I do think it's a discussion we should be having.
Okay, sure.
If that's okay with you.
Sure. Yeah, that would be fine. So, and welcome, Mr. Gillen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peter Gillen. I live at 1856 Dayton Avenue in St. Paul here. And I've spent a large portion of my working life involved in both water and air quality issues for both the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And throughout my career, I believe very strongly that the government has an obligation to foster improvements in both air in both air quality and water quality, to seek out either administrative solutions or technical solutions that will improve the environment, and I still believe that. There are all kinds of technologies available for solving all kinds of problems. This morning I saw in the paper a picture in Haiti of a man digging a ditch for disposing of human waste. And I'm really bothered by that, but that's where they're at. But I also know that 10 days after the earthquake, 10 days after the earthquake, there was one system in Haiti that was operating at in excess of 95%. And I thought, well, what is this? What is this? 95%. And how many people here have one of these in their pockets? The communication system in Haiti was up and running 10 days afterwards. I have no idea how many decades it's going to take to get them back in the water supply and wastewater treatment issue. The technology is there. My sense is that the Pollution Control Agency has not advanced that cause. From what I hear today, it is essential, absolutely necessary, that the rules be taken into account to foster new kinds of technology. I shouldn't say new kinds of technology, because these technologies have been around for quite some time. I feel fortunate, and I'll conclude with that, I feel fortunate that my grandfather, as audacious as he was in suggesting that he put indoor plumbing into the house that I grew up in, put indoor plumbing in 1930 with a two-stage reinforced concrete septic tank. My mother had wastewater treatment in her house as she grew up 7 years before there was any kind of wastewater collection and treatment here in the metro area. Thank you, Grandfather Julius. And I'll take any questions.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Gillen. Any questions? Okay, seeing no questions, thanks again for your testimony. And we do have one more testifier, Mr. Grant Merritt. He's here. Right. And Mr. Merritt is with Parks and Trails Council, former Minnesota PCA commissioner.
Thank you very much, and I'll be brief, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Committee,
if you can state your name for the tape before we begin, please.
All right. Grant Merritt. I live in New Hope. And having served at the PCA some 35 years ago, I've lived with these kinds of problems, and I'm here just to reaffirm on behalf of the Elstons, whom I represent, that we're long past the time to encourage better sewage treatment for new developments where you have a choice between sewering the lakes that we sewer oftentimes and promoting individual systems. They've got a system which I'm familiar with, I've seen it, which works, which would be an excellent alternative, but under these rules they would not be able to do it because of concern about what would happen in the future. Very speculative and hypothetical and unfair discussion. The commissioner, in a letter to the Elstons in December of last year, said that what they're asking for is to allow a type 1 gray water treatment system to be used in calculating the required amount of land. And if that were the case, it would use 40% less land. It's currently the system. And so there is a change that's needed. These rules do need to be changed to allow that type of gray water type 1 system to be calculated. And therefore, we would be able to allow building on smaller lots, which I think is something that we talked about generally in the environmental movement for a long time. But the PCA needs to do more to conserve land. I've long time talked for all these years about how we build these lagoons out in the rural areas, or waste stabilization ponds, which consume 40, sometimes 80 acres, when you could put a mechanical plant on an acre and a half. I had a case in Lake Crystal where we did that, and we succeeded in changing the proposed 40-acre lagoon, and that mechanical plant is in and is functioning today. This is the same kind of thing, to conserve land, use this technology, which the Elstons have developed. Others have it. They're not the only ones that is available, but they can't use it. They can't implement it. I also had a case not too long ago in Alexandria, just a couple years ago, where the local area north of the Alexandria sewage treatment facility wanted to sewer seven more lakes, and the issue there was whether they should sewer it or not. And these lakes did not have development, just a few homes on those lakes. I went out there and promoted, and I didn't know the Elston at this time, but I did know through a friend of mine who's an engineer about the Aquarius system, their system. And it's very difficult to combat these proposed sewering of lakes, which aren't always necessary. Sometimes you do need to do it. I know when I was at the PCA, we sewered Green Lake, and it was probably a good idea back in 1972. Today, there is this alternative, which saves money, promotes jobs, promotes economic development, conserves land, and is much better for the state of Minnesota. So I hope you will consider. And it's interesting to me that you have oversight of rules of agencies now. We didn't have it when I was there. Of course, you know, being in the agency, I thought, well, that's a pretty good idea. We know more than the legislators. So why not let us run the show? Well, the agency people don't always know the best answer. And so you need oversight. You need to instruct the PCA, encourage them to conserve land, encourage them to change these rules so that the Elston type Aquarius system can be used. Thank you very much. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
And thank you, Mr. Merritt.
I know you've run a long time. Appreciate very much your time here.
You bet. You bet.
Good luck.
No problem. And I see no questions. So, and Representative Wagenius, did you want to wait for the information, or would you like the PCA to step down now for a few minutes?
I think we need to
move on.
I can't.
in good conscience say,
sure,
let's do it now.
Okay, okay. Okay, I guess we do need to approve the minutes just before we adjourn here. So, Representative McNamara?
I'll move the minutes of
February 18th.
February 18th.
Yeah, thank you. Representative McNamara moves the minutes of February 18th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted, and the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.